Okay. So we're into November, and we've probably, all of us have done a couple of weeks of school. I'm Melody Milne, and sorry, a couple months of school. And I'm going to be presenting today your conference call. Really exciting kinds of things going on at LEMI. And I just want to let you know that we are starting to schedule trainings for next year. If any of you are interested in bringing a training to your area, you can contact us at registerlemi@gmail.com and let us know what your interests are so we can get that on the calendar for the coming up year. We're hoping that we will be able to increase our amount of trainings that we do this year, this coming up year, but we also do have that one remote training that you can bring to your area or bring to any area that is very small. It's a little less expensive than going to a training, and you do it by facilitator, so you don't bring a trainer there. It's video recordings. We've had a couple of really successful trainings done that way, so that is another option. We are working on the Key of Liberty, getting it to be a remote training. We ran out of funds a little bit, so we are putting that on pause until we have enough funds to finish it. But we're hoping to be able to offer all of our trainings in that kind of way, a remote setting. So those are the announcements that I have this morning. So let's go ahead and get started. Today I want to talk a little bit about what I call the conspiracy of disconnection. And I kind of picked up that term from John Taylor Gatto as I was mentoring with him for a little bit. And it's something that he has a great angst about in public school, in his public school teaching experience. And as I've pondered over it over the years, I've realized how many places this conspiracy of disconnection has infiltrated into our society. And I'm going to talk about this conspiracy of disconnection in conjunction with the new mentor skills that we are all trying to apply this year. And I hope that you're having success doing that. But as we I want to just tell you a little story. So my daughter Natalia, she's 31 now, and we started homeschooling her when she was a preschooler. When she was about 4, we started homeschooling her, and then, you know, I'm sure you all know, get the you've been through this process where you get cold feet. You feel like, oh, what am I doing? I don't know if I can do this. And so I got cold feet and decided that I wasn't sure I would be able to do it, to teach her how to read. And so when she got a little older, we decided to put her into first. Well, she went to kindergarten, hoping that she would learn how to read there. And then I thought maybe I'd bring her home and we'd do the homeschool thing again. So we did something during the summer, and I was doing something with my other daughter, and because I thought, oh, what could kindergarten do to hurt? And then I got nervous again and put her into public school in first grade while I was working with my other daughter again. And you know, we all know we make all kinds of mistakes and we do it all wrong the first time and we have to correct ourselves. But she went to first grade, and then I realized, oh, I can do this. I'm not going to keep sending her to school. So I brought her home permanently. So we did kind of the in and out thing for the first couple of years, but and I was working with my other children. And then, of course, you know, in your mind, you think to yourself, what harm can a kindergarten do? What harm could whatever do? And many years later, as an adult, my daughter made a confession to me. She said, "Mom, do you know that I had anxiety my whole life? And do you know that I actually, the most anxiety I get is when I go to the park?" She says, "I can't take my children to a park. I get so much anxiety." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, when I was in first grade, during recess, I didn't have any friends. And, you know, there was the playground and all that stuff that we could do." She said, "But because I didn't have any friends, every time they said it was time for recess, I would go into a panic." And she said, "And then when I would get out on the playground, the kids would make fun of me." She says, "And I've never recovered from that." She says, I know I need to work through it, but she said, "A lot of the anxiety that I experience these days is about my experience in first grade." She said, "My little daughter, Bethany, has a group school. She homeschools her kids. She has a group school, and she takes her once a week. And she says, every time I go to group school to take Bethany, I get anxiety." She says, "And I know it's directly related to my experience in first grade." I'm thinking to myself, wow, really? How did that happen? How did, she says, "Otherwise, my childhood was, you know, charmed. I had an awesome childhood. I had the most freedom that any child could ever imagine. I learned the things I wanted to learn. I had this amazing experience as a teenager. I had wonderful friends." She said, "But I have these serious inabilities as an adult because of my first grade experience." And I'm bringing this up because I want to talk a little bit about how is it that we as adults make decisions and disconnect from what we know is right and what the common social messages are. You know, in the end, her story is going to be fine. She's going to work things out. We're working on things there, because I'm helping her reconnect with her past, and she's doing some other therapies that help her kind of figure out her anxiety. But I wonder how many of us and how many of our children experience this level of anxiety because of the disconnection that we are experiencing. I think that we disconnect. Okay, so I think that that as human beings, if we connect with one another, we have great relationships. And if we connect our whole world to everything, the thing I like to say is everything is everything. If we connect that everything is everything, then, you know, in my mind, I wouldn't have disconnected. I can teach her how to read without having to send her to school, because that was my biggest fear, right? But if I really understood the concept that everything is everything, I could have used all the experience that I had to be able to realize that I was okay, that I could have done this. Brene Brown, in her book, Men and Women of Worthiness, talks about disconnection. And she says that the way that we shame one another, the way that we get into a shame spin, and the way that we begin to feel like we're unworthy or we're incapable of doing something, is because of disconnection. And she says that if we will truly make a desire, I mean make a plan and have a desire to connect with one another, that she calls it the shame gremlins. The shame gremlins have no place to be inside of you. And over the years, as I've studied about disconnection, I've realized that we are disconnected in our society in so many ways. We disconnect our subjects. You know, we study social behaviors without studying their languages and without studying their math. We study science without studying philosophy. We study philosophy without studying human nature. We disconnect all of our subjects so that when we study history, we can only study history. What happened in the past? We study English and we just study literature without studying the people of the literature. We study math without really understanding the history of math and going back to where the concept of numbers came from and why zero wasn't a number for how many years. And so that's a whole conspiracy in and of itself. Understanding why zero is so important and why it wasn't introduced to cultures many hundreds and hundreds of years ago is because it had too much power. And it gives meaning to what we're studying. But if we disconnect it, if we disconnect the subjects, and if we just teach our children, here is the information that I want you to have, and here's what I want you to memorize, and here's what you have to have on your test, and here's what you have to be able to pass the test and look like you're good and right, then what it does for me is, you know, makes you a robot, makes me look good as a teacher, and I've done my job, and it's quantifiable. I can count it, and I can prove that whatever it is that I'm doing is good and right, and so society accepts me, and we end up forcing, we use compulsion to shove the information down to the children. And I happen to think that that is a conspiracy of evil. I can see that it also affects, this attitude of disconnection affects all of our relationships with one another. It affects our morality. When we have this concept that we go to school and we're robots at school, and we're there to get this information shoved inside of us and forced down us, then, and we have to regurgitate it, it gives us this element of angst. And we disconnect our moral behavior from what is happening during the weekdays. And so our Sunday worship doesn't carry over into the rest of our lives. Now, I'm speaking to the choir here because I know that homeschooling actually reconnects everything. It reconnects the family to each other. It reconnects all learning together. It reconnects our Sundays and our Sunday worship, you know, spills into the rest of our week. We reconnect it that way because we do devotionals and we're able to pray and we're able to sing. So I know for sure that I'm speaking to the choir. I'm not reaching the ears that I'd really like to talk to. But I want to bring to your attention why we are doing what we're doing. because it will give us more meaning and we can more purposefully connect our what we do in our classes and what we do with our students. And we can understand more and have more purpose why we do project learning, because we're trying to reconnect all of the pieces of the puzzle and make it meaningful. In the book, Teaching with the Brain in Mind, they've done a lot of research on the brain, and this is what just kills me, is that they've done all this research in the brain. They know how the brain works and how information and knowledge is best sticks in the brain and creates a meaningful synapse in the brain. And that they know the two most important things, a relationship and relevance. If a child has a relationship with the knowledge, or a relationship even with a teacher, the knowledge becomes meaningful. If a child can see the relevance in their life, how it could apply, how it could make them, it could change them, or how it could be interesting to them, then it sticks in their brain. You don't have to force it in. It automatically becomes part of what they know. Now, I'm not telling you that I don't believe in academic rigor where we memorize lists. I think memorizing lists are really great. I think memorizing vocabulary is really good. I think memorizing formulas is really good. I think that we should have certain things that are required of us, especially in scholar phase, that are difficult. Memorizing the Declaration of Independence, I think, is part of something that's difficult. It's academic rigor. I think children should learn how to take tests eventually when it's right. Eventually they're going to have to cross that hurdle. That's why we do, in Key of Liberty, offer several tests on the Constitution. That's why we have vocabulary tests in Shakespeare Conquest. We want to introduce that test taking rigor at these levels so that they can get exposed to having to memorize things, having to put something into their memory banks and recall it. But in all, we want to be able to see how the Constitution affects our lives today. We want to be able to see where we got the document and why the people who wrote the document wrote what they wrote. And we want to be able to connect the interesting history behind the people and how they thought of the document and what led up to writing the document. And we want to know the document itself. We want to understand the principles in the document. We want to be able to connect the logic of why we would declare independence, because this, and this, if this, then that. So we want to be able to make that a whole learning experience. And we want to be able to write about it. We want to be able to learn how to write while we're writing about it. We want to be able to connect the literature of the people back then so that we know what affected them. And, you know, in the Civil War, in our project, the Sword of Freedom, two of the best pieces that we read as part of the project is Uncle Tom's Cabin and To Kill a Mockingbird. And the reason why we do that is because Uncle Tom's Cabin affected the people so deeply that that's when they began to see what was going on in their society, and it began to really pull on the hearts of the people and get them behind the cause of the abolition of slavery. We can't study the history without studying that literature. And we certainly can't understand why they fought so passionately and their battles were so intense without understanding the logic of why they thought they were there. And I can go on and on and on and on about why our projects are the way that they are, because we are trying to overcome this barrier of disconnection that I think has been the conspiracy of disconnection introduced to our children, to ourselves, in our society today. So I said I want to connect this to the new mentor skills that we are learning this year. This year, I introduced 5 new mentor skills, and I wrote a handbook last winter and asked you all to purchase the handbook and begin to implement the mentor skills. I'm going to remind you what those mentor skills are. I'm going to give them to you in a certain order today so that and talk to you about them in that order. Then I want to show you how we can use them in an order, and I'm not telling you they have to come in order, but I'm going to show you how they can work in an order that will help you use them more effectively. So the first one I'm going to introduce today is honoring. And all of you know that honoring means to honor where they're at. Don't make them wrong. I like to say honoring is making them right. When we make someone right where they're at, it makes them feel accepted. So if we have a child in our classroom who doesn't know how to spell, and our little teacher brains and our little judgment brains say, oh my gosh, you're 14 years old. Why haven't you learned how to spell? And then we go to town trying to figure out how to teach them how to spell, or we go to town thinking, you know what, this kid doesn't even know what he's talking about. He can't spell. Or we go, you know, whatever it is, the judgment that keeps going on in our mind. As we make them wrong, they feel that disconnect, that discord from us. And it's an energetic disconnect. And I think that's actually where disconnection begins. As we shame ourselves or we shame other people, we energetically begin to disconnect with one another. And we have to make this huge effort to overcome this hurdle of energy so that we can reconnect. And in my mind, it is as real and tangible as me reaching out with my hand and touching someone, or me recoiling my hand and not touching someone. This energy that we create between the two of us when we don't honor each other. For some reason, we have in our mind that there's this certain way and a certain path that everyone needs to be on, and we as good, moral, upstanding people sometimes I hope you're struggling with that. I hope you're grappling with that all the time, that there isn't a predetermined path that every single person has to be on. You know, we spend our lives trying to figure out, you know, why this person can't read up, you know, at the level that I think that they should read, and why this person can't write up to the level that I think they should write, and why can't they spell, and whatever those things, and without allowing for the process of their lives and their growth to take place. I had a daughter who was diagnosed with dyslexia when she was 8 years old. She was having a difficult time reading. I didn't know at the time what was going on. I was new at homeschooling, and of course I told you I was a little insecure at what I was doing. And I had a really awesome therapist to tell me. She said, don't get her into any kind of reading therapy right now. She says, get her into piano lessons. What they need right now, what she needs right now, is a right brain, left brain crossover. She needs the synapses to grow in her brain so that she can make the connections in her brain, because the problem is in her brain right now. So if you focus on reading, she's going to get a lot of angst about reading, and it's going to cause a lot of disconnection in her brain. So focus on getting the right brain, left brain crossover. And so, you know, we used piano lessons as therapy for her. Many, 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 many years of therapy. Where she had to use a right hand and a left hand together. And then what she had to do is make the connection between the notes on the piano and the notes on the page, or the keys on the piano and the notes on the page. All of that was working on her brain and the synapses of her brain. And it was also a great attitude of honoring. We don't, if we honor where our students are, where we are, it makes life so much less stressful. I also like to say honoring is suspending judgment. Okay, the next one that I want to talk about is reflective listening. As we take this attitude of honoring where they're at, we can more easily, instead of trying to correct them and what they're saying, we can more easily want to know and understand what they have to say. And when we reflective listen, or we, some people call it drive-through listening, where it's kind of like a drive-through fast food place where you pull up to the window and you say, I would like a cheeseburger, a large fry, and a shake. And the person at the window says, you would, okay, so you would like a cheeseburger, a cone, and a shake. No, that's not what I said. I would like a cheeseburger, a large fry, and a shake. Oh, you want a cheeseburger, a large fry, and a shake. Yes, that's what I want. That's kind of that reflective listening, or drive-through listening. And as we use our reflective listening skills, we can understand what they're saying better, and actually we can begin to teach. So let me give you an example of something. I had a student once say, you know, I really don't even know why I want to know anything about George Washington, because a lot of the people in the world tell me that he was actually a really bad man, and that he was egotistical, and he was you know, all about himself, and he was very selfish. And why would we study a man like that if, you know, we're trying to study great men? And you know, my little judgment mind's going to say, oh my gosh, what have you read about him? How have you heard those things about him? And, you know, and I can actually get up in arms about that, you know, because I love this man, right? And I can begin to create this energy of disconnection by not honoring them. Or I could make the decision to honor where they're at. And in my little brain, I can say to myself, interesting. That is an interesting message that our world is giving to the people in the United States. And then I could say to myself, step back, I want to know what this person thinks, or how this person came to this. So I'm going to say, so what I think I hear you saying is, it's difficult for you to have a reason to spend time reading about someone you think is dishonorable. And And, you know, they can say, well, yeah, that's probably it. I don't want to spend my time reading about somebody who's dishonorable. Well, that's not the exact words that he said, but those are the words that I kind of put into it. And using those words that I understand, that dishonorable, he said egotistical and selfish, but I kind of grouped it into a more into a bigger picture, dishonorable. Then we can start having a better conversation. And then I can turn to the class and say, why would we want to study? And I still haven't addressed the whole idea that he isn't dishonorable, because I'm still honoring. And then I can turn to the class and I ask, why would we want to study about people who might be dishonorable? And then we can have a nice little discussion about that. And then instead of confronting this child and saying, you know, George Washington wasn't dishonorable at all, and he wasn't egotistical, and these messages that you're getting from the mainstream mainstream culture is lying to you, instead of saying that, I can turn back to the rest of the class and say, actually, let's talk about this. Does anyone here think from their reading that they got the sense that George Washington was dishonorable? Or maybe even let's talk about the words that he used, egotistical and selfish. And then the classroom can have that discussion. But first of all, I didn't dishonor this young man who got this message. I accepted him. I reflected back what he said to me. And then we came to an agreement on, yes, I'm going to say that I think selfish and or egotistical and selfish means dishonorable. So we came to an understanding and agreement on our terms. And then I asked the right question. And I'm going to give you guys a minute to write that down. Asking the right question. Okay, I want you to think for just a second, what were some of the right questions that I asked? And what are some of the right questions you could come up with from a conversation like that? And I'm going to actually open this up for discussion. If you have some thoughts about how you could handle this, I want you to unmute yourself, and I'll call on you. Actually, if you would prefer, you can raise your hand and then I can unmute you. That's what we need to do. Raise your hand by pressing. Hold on 1 second. There's a lot of callers here, and I think it is *5. You know what? Actually, I don't see anybody raising their hand, and I do want to have some feedback here or some discussion. So, Angela, I see that you're on. I'm going to go ahead and unmute you, and let's discuss this. Some of the things, the ways that you could handle, the ways that you could handle this. Angela.
Oh, while it was unmuting, I couldn't hear what you were saying. So could you ask my question one more time?
I am asking the question, what are some right questions that we could come up with as we're having this conversation about George Washington? I introduced one way I could handle it. What are some of your thoughts?
Okay. Well, you asked what are some questions that you could ask, and I would ask why he felt like that. I would ask what does it matter? Do the good things that George Washington did matter? You know, are do they outweigh the bad, or does bad outweigh the good? Those are a couple of questions.
I love that question. And would you ask that question to him or to the class? How would you handle that?
I would ask that question to the class, mostly because I think that when somebody, that particular question comes up with a lot of different people. And because everybody we study has good and bad. And there's a lot of kids that have those questions, including myself. I've had those questions. So I would ask that question for the class. And so sometimes the other kids in the class will bring up things that he hasn't thought of. And also, if the kids haven't heard that question before, at some point they're going to have that question for themselves. Now is a great time to bring it up so that they can talk about it and listen to everybody's comments.
Yeah, I love that insight. I love that you said that. So before you came to class, could you have come up with that question? Would that question have been something on your list necessarily of questions you could ask in your discussion?
You know, if it were Martin Luther King Jr., it might have been on my list, but probably
right.
Wouldn't have been on my list for George Washington.
Exactly,
because
right.
He doesn't have that much bad
right.
stuff, you know. Yeah, so it probably wouldn't have been on my list, but it would be, I think it would have been a say go be do. As soon as I started to hear that question, I think I would have been pulled that direction.
Yeah, so it's kind of going with the flow of the class, right? Because if you're honoring where your students are, you can't always come with these prepared questions. And you have to go where the class and where each one of the students is. So to some degree, you have to allow the participants to dictate the direction of the discussion, right? But you also can bring in some of your own agendas, if you will.
Well, and you can be inspired to have that question while you're preparing questions. You might have an inspiring moment where you think, you know what, this would make a great discussion. I'm going to include this. And so you might be inspired while you're preparing questions. But I think that every time you go into a discussion, you need to be prepared to go with the kids and to go where they're taking you, because that's usually where they need to be.
Yeah. And it's very validating for a student when you give to the class a question that you've asked, that they've asked, because then they realize, oh, wow, my head is going in places that are good.
Yeah, and you can give them credit. You can say, somebody asked this in their paper, and I wanted to share it because I thought it was a really good question, and I've wondered it myself. So
yeah.
You can give them credit, and then you really are validating them.
Very good. Thank you for that. Okay. So thank you, Angela, for your input. You know what, Angela? Is it 5-star if they want to raise their hand?
I don't
know.
Let me go look at my – I'll go look at my computer and see.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay, so when we do our reflective listening, when we do our honoring, that is when we can come up with some of the right questions. Now, we're asking the right questions, what we want to be able to do is this balance between following the flow of the conversation and having some of our own kind of agendas or things that we want to be able to bring out in discussion so that we can keep moving forward some of the things we know that they need to be learning. But as we go with the flow of the questions, it becomes very affirming. And then that we are using another mentor skill, the validating and affirming. The last mentor skill is relating. And sometimes you could even, when you're doing reflective listening, you can go into this kind of relating, like, let's go back to that conversation of George Washington. So I would say to him, so what I think you're saying to me, and I always like to have this little script. So what you're saying is, or what I think I hear you saying is, and let me know if this is wrong. You know, I want to invite a little discussion here. Let me know if this is wrong. But what I think I hear you saying is, you know, you don't think it's valuable for us to be discussing people. Oh, someone did raise their hand. Rochelle raised her hand. What is this, Rochelle?
Yes, this is Rochelle.
And you did raise your hand?
I did.
And what?
Actually,
did
I was just thinking.
Raise your hand.
Star 5.
Oh, awesome.
But it only worked some of the times because I had to do it several times.
Oh, my gosh, how ridiculous. And I have somebody else here raising their hand, too, so just hold on. Yes, go ahead, Rochelle.
Okay, I would ask if that student and then the class could give examples of George Washington being selfish or dishonorable, and then discuss those things and ask if during his lifetime he had corrected that situation or that defect. And then, you know, towards the end of the conversation, you know, let the students all discuss that and then say, you know, thank goodness for repentance because none of us are perfect.
Okay, so you would bring it to a whole new level of discussion, which I love actually. Oh, I love that direction, Michelle, because what you could do is talk about your mistakes that we make in our lives or attitudes that we've had in our lives, and is it going to reflect on us in our history and our legacy that we leave? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that. So, and you would have to do that kind of artfully because you would be honoring. You would say, okay, that's a valid thing. Yeah. Can anyone give me examples of that? You would just go, yeah, I love that. It's very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I have somebody else. The phone number is 801-499-9124.
That's mine and Elodie. This is Anne.
And oh, hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I was just thinking I would probably ask them if they were going about doing a great deal of good and someone was jealous of them or didn't want them to accomplish it, would they perhaps try to make them look bad so that people wouldn't or want to follow in the direction that they were trying to lead? Would they try to tear their character down? And does that mean that they're a bad person or that someone was just starting rumors? Because that has happened a lot, you know, to
yeah.
some of the founding fathers. And so it happens today. It happened back then. That could that be a possibility also?
Yeah, so maybe what you would say is as you're in your reflective listening mode and your honoring mode, you would say something like, I think this is a common belief. Could this be a possible reason why this is a common belief? And
right,
you know, because of jealousy and whatever. Yeah. You know, yeah, and see if you could get your classroom to start talking maybe about the kind of media that we have out there that, you know, is doesn't give us the full picture, doesn't give us the truth because of the jealousy and competition that they feel towards one another.
Right. So I'd probably use an example of today and then let them help connect the dots. So could that happen back then? Could someone be trying to...
Well, even today, someone could you look at their lives today and be jealous, right?
Yeah.
You know, our modern histories are the ones that are writing this kind of stuff. I don't think we're going to see that so much in the... Yeah.
So they don't have to live up to standards that were perhaps pretty common, good moral standards as they did back then. They can undermine all of that so they can justify living beneath good standards.
Yeah.
Anyways, that was my thought, that I might have to start thinking along those lines.
But this would be a good discussion for the kids to have these days, right? This is actually a really good discussion for the kids to have in discussing this. Because it's something they grapple with, these kids, you know, this competition, this media that we have to deal with, this, you know, the messages that are all wrong messages and ourself and our own characters and the characters of the people that we vote for. Yeah, that's the real conversation we want to be having at Key of Liberty.
Well, and it happens in modern politics because people will start a rumor or try to make it look like someone's not a good person. A lot of good people don't want to go into politics because so much of this goes on to try to tear someone's character down and start false rumors that are not even true. And so, need to be aware of those things happen to modern people in modern days, and people do it today for people of old in history if they try to rewrite history.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you very much for that. Okay, I have another hand raised. And the phone number is 801-819-8434. I'm going to unmute. Whoops,
hey.
Hold on. Okay, there
can you hear me?
Who is this?
This is Jessica Lambert.
Jessica.
I tried to raise my hand earlier too, but I would ask at this point in the discussion how we find and recognize good sources and trustworthy sources when we have I'm pushing buttons again. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh? Okay, sorry. And how we when we have two different sources, you know, what we're reading in class and what the student has heard elsewhere, how do we choose which one is the most trustworthy? And you can even bring in the use of the spirit, listening to the spirit, when you know you can't tell otherwise, that the Holy Ghost can testify to you of truth, whether it's specifically a gospel truth or something like this, where was George Washington a good man or was he egotistical and selfish?
So I really, really like that idea of asking them how to find legitimate sources. And that's a problem these days. I mean, how would they answer that question? Where do you think the conversation would go from there?
I think it could go a lot of places. In fact, that's a question that I don't think I necessarily know all the answers to. We could talk about original sources, why that's usually one of my main measuring sticks to finding trust. how original is it?
Yeah. I just had an idea. This might be an opportunity for us to introduce the George Washington's farewell address, where we get his words from him, and we can kind of get a measure of his character through some of the words that he said, right? And see if we could detect in some of his own words what kind of character he had and what kind of vision he had for the nation or for himself, right?
Yeah.
You're saying.
Yeah.
and original sources. That would be one of the original sources. Good. And it would get them thinking, well, where do I go for stuff like that? And you may not have an answer. You know, you may, as a mentor, say, I don't always know the best. I just know that if I can get closest to the original, then I have a better chance of getting a better picture. Which, you know, then you can talk about modern literature, who that reaches back into those original sources. One of, there's a new book out on George Washington, I think is a very, very good book. And but it's big and fat and takes a long time to get through. It has become one of my favorite books on George Washington. It's called Washington. I feel like he does a really great job getting back to the sources, but this might be an opportunity for you to say, let's look at this book that we're reading and see what sources they're drawing on. And that would be super powerful, because then that gives them a whole new skill level, right?
Right.
Very good.
That can be so useful in every aspect of their education, and so it brings it beyond just what you're studying right then.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Jessica. Okay, I have another hand. I'm going to call on, it's 703-789-1699. Can you tell me who that is?
Hi, this is Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Susan Van Cleef, you know me. I think I would tend to take this in a, and maybe because I'm working with older kids, but I would want to explore whether people can do really great things, can really contribute to society and not be perfect people. We aren't perfect people. And I think that we can over-glorify people from the past, which makes it seem like we are not like that. We know we're not perfect. So how can we ever accomplish these really great things? And the truth is, everybody's flawed, and yet flawed people do great things.
So you would take it to the question of, after you kind of got where he, you know, you reflective listened back and forth, and you got the idea of, yes, this is where he's at, the student's at, then you would take it to the class and say, okay, let's talk about that. Is it possible for people to do great things and still not be perfect? Let's assume maybe that George Washington was egotistical and selfish, and, you know, maybe he was. We don't, you know, we never actually really can know the truth of that, right? Let's just say he was. Could he do something great?
That's right. Yeah. And do we want to push him aside? If that is indeed, you know, a true part of his character, do we want to then ignore these other parts of his character which are really great and that we would want to try and emulate?
Yeah, and you know, I got the same problem with Martin Luther King Jr., right? You know, I know a lot of bad things about Martin Luther King Jr. I have to look at, what did he do in our society that helped our society? And, you know, I can see a lot of bad things that came out of the civil rights movement, but I can also see a lot of really good things. And you and I, who aren't Southerners, may not see the impact or feel the impact as much as those people in the South did from what he did. But if I could put my feet into their territory for a little while, I think I could some of the really great stuff that he did. So yeah, that's a really excellent question. Winston Churchill, same thing. He had some bad habits. He wasn't always the best character in the world, but I'm going to tell you what, he did some good things in World War II.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Susan, for sharing. That was a great place to go. Okay, I have another hand up. It's 208-680-9342. And I'm going to unmute. Can you tell me who this is?
Hi, this is Jamie Borup.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I am just looking at the whole principle of asking the right question from, I'm kind of a new mentor, and I'm trying to kind of see the overarching principles, I guess, the way that you come up with questions, because obviously we can't, like, make a list of these are the right questions to ask, because we never know what
right.
will come up.
Right.
So I've been kind of, as I've been listening to these examples of questions, I've come up with some different sort of categories, I guess, or ideas of what the asking the right questions should accomplish. And I was just, so one of them is maybe asking them to give some examples, maybe clarify their opinion, and that would go with reflective listening. And then,
yeah, and you know what? Also, it is going to teach them some critical thinking, you know. so I try not to be confrontational with my students. You know, you're wrong, I want you, whatever. But I want to bring out some critical thinking skills. So that direction that you're saying, hey, give me some sources kind of thing, actually really helps them to say, wait, you mean I can't just throw out opinions here?
Right.
Yeah,
and then
another
one that I saw happening is maybe asking, like, what from your learning or your experience leads you to believe this, which kind of ties in with that. And then the big thing that I'm seeing is that we can ask a question that kind of examines true principles or maybe relevant issues connected with the question or comment that was brought up, and then bring it up for discussion with the class.
That. Yeah, I like to take that, and you're on the right track. As a new mentor, you're on the right track, because I like to take what I'm, this little intimate conversation that I had for this brief moment with this child, this student, who I'm now connected with, and everyone in the class can feel that we had a connection. And so they begin to feel safer. And then take that information and take it to the rest of the class. Now we've established a little bit of a territory of safe ground. Very good. Thank you for your comments. Lots of good insight. I'm sure you're an awesome mentor.
So you can.
Okay. Yeah, good discussion. Okay, so... then, of course, as the other two mentor skills that we've been talking about is affirming and validating, and then relating. Now, these are mentor skills that must be artfully done in order to create an atmosphere of safety in the discussion time, and also invites really good deep discussion. So I want to just bring out one more thing. And so when we use the mentor skills, what we're doing is creating this atmosphere of safety, but we're also creating an opportunity for our students to connect with one another, because remember, we're talking about connection and this conspiracy of disconnection. And the environment of group discussion itself is a great opportunity for us to jump at the hurdle of disconnection, which is why we want to use the environment of discussion and use it well with one another. I really love it when I can get two students debating back and forth or talking about issues, and that I'm not the center and focus of their discussion anymore. So sometimes I'll get strategic and say, you know, Miss Jenny over here has a lot to say. She and I have had to discuss the character of people. And, you know, Mr. John over here, he believes that George Washington is selfish and egotistical. And I just want to give an opportunity for Miss Jenny to tell us some of the things that she's been thinking in her mind, because I have a sense that she's got some important things to say right now, because I know where she, how that she feels strongly about this subject. And then I can get them talking. It also validates some of the thoughts she's had, or I can say, in so-and-so's paper, they actually brought that up. And then I can, ask that student, Susan, I understand this is something you brought up in your paper, and I can get a conversation going between the two students. Remember, especially in the practice scholar level, you're trying to get them to get used to talking to each other intellectually, critically, using respectful language, honoring each other, staying on topic, because we have 12-year-olds who want to just talk about everything in the world. And I have students who think they're on topic and they're not on topic, but when I do the reflective listening, I put words in their mouth so that they can see that they could be on topic and they could get back on topic. It's kind of a skill, artful skill, that you could use. Okay. So I'm going to go to the next skill of relating. So this is the ultimate connection skill. When our students know and understand that we have had experiences or experienced things that they are experiencing, all of a sudden they realize that we share common understanding. We share something together. So it puts us on a level playing ground. And when I do this, I notice that I do it, and I tend to do it in a use my body language to do it. So when we're in a discussion format, reading a book, typically I sit down with them and we sit in a circle. But when I'm in a more of a lecture format where I'm presenting my material and we start a discussion, which I like to encourage. A lot of times I will step down. I'm standing, and then maybe I'll sit down on the table or lean against the table so that I am coming down physically a little bit to them. And then I'll look them in the eye, look straight at them and say, you know what? I've been grappling with that exact same question. I'd like to know what you guys think in this class so that we can understand, get a better understanding. And that may not even be, maybe it's just a tactic. I may really have some strong answers for that child about the character of a man, but if I give them all my answers, they won't find their own. So maybe some people can't say, I've been grappling with that. I have been right now grappling with that. Maybe you can say, I've grappled with that in the past too. What do you guys think? It brings me right back down to, I'm a student too. I'm learning with you. Remember, we don't have to have all the answers, and we don't want to give all the answers even if we do have the answers. We want to talk less and let them talk more, and while they stay on subject. If you can become this mediator between good conversation, for me, that's a better environment, because Louis L'Amour says, all education is self-education, and if I don't give you the opportunity to discover it on your own, you're not going to know it. Now, I've had the privilege in the past of working with some amazing mentors who have so much knowledge, and I have a friend who, she just has this wealth of knowledge about the Constitution. And I would love to just sit at her feet and just drink in everything she knows about the Constitution. But the truth of the matter is, she's going to have all of this knowledge, and as she tries to disseminate it down to me, unless she gives it to me in a format that I can memorize and that is meaningful to me, I'll probably get about 10% of what she's giving me. I'll take away about 10%. And typically when somebody is up there lecturing, you know, and we're taking lecture notes and we don't have a test for it or any or something like that, we don't have any need to memorize what they're telling us unless we can feel the how it relates to us, how it's relevant to us, right? Okay, so I want to go back to reflective listening because reflective listening for me is the catalyst. When a child feels understood, when they feel like you care about what they think, that is when a child becomes free from their own misunderstandings. I want you guys to think about that for a minute. When a child or when a student or when anybody knows that you, it feels that we care what they think or what's in their head, that student, that person, is now free to change their mind. Can anyone, I'm going to have you guys raise hands again. Can anyone tell me why you think that's the case? What do you think is happening inside of a person who feels understood and why now they're free to change their mind? Anne.
And Elodie?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think they can take their defenses down.
Yeah.
Because when we don't feel understood, we've got to stand our ground and keep our defenses up. But when we feel like we're safe and understood, we can put them down and then carry on the dialogue and reconsider
right.
our position.
Right. So it gives them an opportunity to take the walls down, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we're using these. And you know, Anne, you've been a teacher for many, many years. You know these students. Are there walls you have to deal with?
What?
Are there walls you have to deal with in these students?
Sometimes.
And sometimes not, right?
Yeah. Sometimes they're quite open. They're like, they don't come with a lot of preconceived opinions at that age in some things. As they get older, they develop that, which is
right.
a good thing to get some opinions and thoughts.
And our mentoring, actually, if we don't do it well, can actually cause walls to go up, couldn't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, all right. Thank you very much for that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else have a comment on that? I think it's star 5 if you want to raise your hand on that. Okay. Yes, I have 735-616-2373. And who is this?
Hi. This is Markel Brown.
Hi, Markel.
Hi. I think that when they feel understood, that then they have an increased. Oops, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, they have an increased feeling of acceptance as well as belonging, and then they no longer have to feel like they have to fit in. because they have that acceptance, and if they can belong, then they can.
I love that. So you're going to get less posturing. You fit in. You're part of us. We're a team here.
Right, and then they can be more authentic, and then they don't have to feel like they have to be in this box, but they can really think how they want to think and how they're being led to think.
Awesome. I love that, that you're helping them feel part of that team. I love that. Thank you. And Joy Petty, Joy, you have your...
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay, so I feel like when they feel validated, then they feel accepted, they feel loved, and they feel safe. And they feel like, okay, you're going to love me even if I have some weird opinion. And so it doesn't matter anymore. If I can change my mind, it's okay. Because
right.
I know that you'll love me even if I change my mind, you know. Even
and
if
you know
I...
What? Joy, I'm really glad you bring that up, because I think I've had students who just express their weird opinions just to test, you know? Right?
Yeah.
See if they will be accepted, right?
Yeah.
You know,
and
this,
just sometimes to make a point or stand out or say, hey, look at me.
Exactly.
I'm important. I'm special. Look at me.
Right. And this is definitely something that happens at this age.
Yes.
Yeah. And they just, maybe they want to feel, they want to just be contrary, just to test us.
Yes, to test
yeah.
us. Yes, indeed.
Very good. Oh, thank you very much, Joy. Okay. So it's 9:16, and I want to wrap things up. Thank you very much for all of your participation today. I'm hoping that you are recommitted to using your mentor skills, especially the reflective listening, because that's where you really get to the place of understanding them. And as I said, I don't necessarily think that these things have to be in this order, but I have found that there is a good way to start, that you, if you start with honoring and then start trying to understand them, you know, how Covey says, please seek first to understand, then be understood. That's that reflective listening part. Then it gives us some of our right questions, and we can do our relating and our affirming and validating throughout that conversation. So, keep in mind that as a mentor, you have permission to pull yourself out of the conversation. That you don't have to have your angst, your frustration, or even prove any of your points. Pull yourself out. Be the fly on the wall. Emotionally, pull yourself out. Let the classroom have their own experience. Don't be so quick and so anxious to answer all their questions that they ask. Let them grapple. Give them time to think things through. Take a position of stepping back. I want to just tell you, I started this whole conversation with the conspiracy of disconnection. I brought it to the mentor skill. I don't think it's the only place that we want, that we can and need to reconnect. But I think I have this idea in my mind that as we use these mentor skills, we will create an atmosphere of reconnecting in our homes, with our friends, with our associates, with our families, our siblings, our parents, our Commonwealth schools. We can use these mentor skills everywhere and start creating a safe place to reconnect in our society. Thank you so much for all your time, all your effort, your dedication. Thank you so much for everything you put up with in your communities. Thank you so much for really being truth seekers and wanting to do the right thing. And I know as you keep working on this, it's going to flush itself out. You're going to make mistakes, but be patient with yourself. Thank you all, and we'll talk to you all next month. Remember that you can use this use the classic calls to have discussions in your own Commonwealth schools. And if you have questions about how to access that, actually, I do have a question. I do have a hand raised. I'm going to take this really quickly. Rochelle, you had your hand raised.
Yes, I do. The manual that you were talking about earlier that was just written, is that available at the Lemmy store, and what's the name of it?
Okay, it's called The Mentor's Handbook.
Okay.
And right now we don't have any. I do have some hard copies, but you can get it on Kindle. It's probably the easiest place for you to get it is on Amazon, the Amazon bookstore.
Okay. Will
okay. do. Thank you for bringing that up. All right. See you all next month. Bye-bye.